You're listening to Justice Radio on WMPG with Rob Ruffner from the Main Engine Defense Center. And today we're continuing our conversation with John Rapping from Gideon's Promise. Last week, or last month rather, we talked about values in culture and its role in building client-centered, robust public defense offices and systems. Today, we're going to continue that conversation and learn more about Gideon's Promise from its genesis to the organization that it is today. I had the good fortune of taking part in Gideon's Promise training that was brought to Maine in June of 2025, and then to do the train-the-trainer track of online and in person in Atlanta. And when we were being taught about culture and values, one of the many things we learned about it was not just culture and value in people and in actions, but in how it manifests in our spaces, in our offices. I think the term that was used was artifacts. What artifacts of our culture do we have in our offices? John, why don't you talk a little bit about artifacts and how they can be impactful and why they're important?
Sure. So just to really kind of summarize what I think I came to understand from all of my research on organizational culture is that culture is a function of values. That as leaders who are consciously thinking about how to transform culture, leaders, they identify a value set consistent with the organization they want to build. In public defense, Gideon's Promise would argue those must be client-centered values. They must center the people we serve. The lawyers then bring people. And as you pointed out in the last episode, Rob, these are lawyers. These are investigators, these are support staff. Every person who's a part of the organization is brought in. You're looking for people that embrace the values that the leaders identified. And leader makes leadership decisions that allow the people to live those values in ways that allow them to achieve success. And as people start to live those values, achieve success, those values become internalized, subconscious. They become what are called assumptions. And when the entire organization shares a set of assumptions, just basic beliefs about how the world operates and how we see people in the world, when the organization shares a set of assumptions, we've shifted values. There is this concept called artifacts. Artifacts are the visible, tangible things that we can see throughout an organization that are proxies for culture. They are the things that our culture should manifest. So, for example, what is the artwork that's on our walls? What do we choose to celebrate, right? Are we celebrating not guilty verdicts, right? Is that what's important to us, going to trial? Are we celebrating dismissals, which may be a reflection of good investigation and hard work that keeps us from going to trial? But what do we celebrate? How do we communicate with each other? How do we dress? All of those are artifacts. And so we have an exercise that we call a culture walk, where you can walk around your office and look for artifacts and ask yourself the question, what do I think the values are that my office embraces? And what artifacts reflect those values? And what artifacts may not reflect those values? Sometimes you'll be surprised because there will be things you can see in your office that really, when you're paying attention, are inconsistent with your values. Rob, I want to tell you a quick story that I think illustrates this. In 2014, Gideon's Promise partnered with the state of Maryland. It was our first statewide partnership. And we started working with the chief defender in Maryland, a man named Paul DeWolf. And Paul DeWolf loved this idea of artifacts and really wanted every office to think about culture. So he issued a sort of a challenge to every office, every district office. And he said, I'm going to give you something like $150. It wasn't a lot. And I want you to use it to create a reception area that reflects your organizational values. And at the annual conference, every office had slides that showed the reception area. And it was beautiful. Some of them had, you know, little bookshelves with children's books that reflected that they cared about families that maybe didn't have daycare. They had artwork on the wall that clients painted. But it really was an exercise in getting every office to think about what does a reception space look like that reflects our values. Some of those spaces before the competition had the metal chairs, the drab walls, the things that without even thinking about it, when you walk in, it screams out to you, this is a place where poor people get legal services. It doesn't mean much. So that's an example of artifacts and how artifacts really can be a reflection of the culture of your office.
So I want to talk about something. Even in the first episode last month, when you talked about yourself and where you started out from DC to Georgia to Louisiana, et cetera. And now we just heard a little bit about Gideon's promise, getting a statewide relationship with Maryland. It seems like there was a little bit of a story there that we're missing in terms of when did Gideon's promise, when did you come into existence, and when did it develop into being so much more than you? I mean, I met the folks at Gideon's Promise when they came to do the training. It was Sean, an amazing group of trainers that were brought in from all over the country, and it was amazing. They clearly share your passion and values, care about teaching us, training us, newer attorneys are new to this type of training, and it made a big impression on me. And I've been doing this for 2.5 decades, way longer than I'd like to admit, and it so energized me. But how do we get there? How did it become this very substantial and I would say impactful organization that I got introduced to last year in 2025?
Yeah, so Gideon's Promise has really grown, and I will say I think that a couple years ago, well, my wife, after almost 18 years with Gideon's Promise and helping me with the precursor to Gideon's Promise, which was a Georgia-based program, she left to take another job. A couple years later, I stepped away, and I think both of us realized after about 20 years of leading Gideon's Promise that if Gideon's Promise was really going to live beyond us, we had to have a succession plan. And as you saw, by the time we stepped away, there was Gideon's Promise was so much more than me or Illy. There was a whole community of incredible lawyers. Most of them came to Gideon's Promise as brand new lawyers and graduated and became leaders in their office. And we invested in developing them into trainers and mentors. And so Gideon's Promise now is a huge community of people who think about developing lawyers, developing public defenders in a certain way. And they have been trained in how to use recruitment and training and mentorship and leadership to do that. Gideon's Promise started in 2007. Based on my experiences in Georgia and Louisiana, we had partnerships in two states, Georgia and Louisiana, 16 lawyers. We had one program. It was a 3-year program for new public defenders. We spent 3 years providing lawyers training and mentorship. And then they'd graduate and they'd go back into these systems that were so corrupted. And they started calling us and saying, now what? What's going to happen to me now if I don't have any support? And so we developed an alumni program to continue to work with graduates of our 3-year, we call it our core program, and to work with them as alumni to become, continue to develop as lawyers, to become mentors, to ultimately become trainers. We then started a leadership program so that the leaders we worked with would both sort of be given lessons in how to support the young lawyers we were training, but also work together to think about how to advocate in their systems for change. We developed a trainer development program, which you participated in, which allowed us to expand the tentacles of our program beyond Georgia, Louisiana, and the South. And we developed a law school pipeline. And so Gideon's Promise grew from Georgia and Louisiana. We started to add states across the South. And then ultimately, we started getting calls from folks like you, Rob, who were not in the South, but were saying, I'm dealing with a lot of the challenges that you all talk about in Mississippi and Georgia and Tennessee. And we started to branch out. We got partnerships beyond the South, and now we have partnerships in more than half the states across the country. As I mentioned, our first statewide partnership was in Maryland in 2014. We've since developed a statewide partnership in Texas. And I think really what we're seeing is, I think, Rob, we are meeting a lot of lawyers like you who've been doing this work for decades. There's nothing we are teaching that you don't understand. There's nothing about the values we teach that you don't embrace yourself. I think what we find is leaders say, "Man, that resonates with me because I embrace those values, and I haven't seen a community that is thinking about them as consciously as Gideon's Promise, and I want to be a part of it because it helps me stay stronger and stay grounded as a leader. It helps me think about how I can bring these values into my office in a way that maybe I didn't understand how to do before." And so Gideon's Promise has really grown into a collection of people who I think have always shared the values and the passion that the Gideon's Promise trainers share. What Gideon's Promise does is it gives them a home, it gives them a hub, it gives them a space where they can think about how to use those values in a way that shape public defense and not be isolated while they're doing it.
You're listening to Justice Radio with Rob Ruffner. And again, we're speaking with John Rapping of Gideon's Promise and professor at Atlanta's John Marshall School of Law. We're talking about values in culture in public defense and public defender systems, as well as Gideon's Promise. It sounds like your work in Georgia and in New Orleans, in terms of training and in developing the office in New Orleans after Katrina, sort of gave you the exposure to that aspect of this advocacy, not direct client advocacy, but training the defenders or, you know, building offices type of thing. And based on our episode last month, that you researched and thought about it a lot, and not just from the perspective of how do public defender offices or litigation offices organize themselves, but you just looked at in general organizations and cultures and in offices and how values and culture are important within them. In addition to the how you described the impact the Gideon's Promise was making as it began, how do the different parts, the new attorney summer institute, sort of that 3-year track with that, the alumni program, the leadership program, the trainer development program, and the law school pipeline, how are they helping achieve Gideon's Promise mission in terms of making an impact, in terms of spreading these values and this culture to far-flung regions like Maine from Atlanta? How does those aspects and those programs help achieve those sorts of that the impact that Gideon's Promise is hoping to have? And what are some of the obstacles in terms of being able to make an impact in different jurisdictions and even with funders who may not be comfortable with certain aspects of the mission, let's say?
Yeah. So what we, I think, understand at Gideon's Promise is training and teaching an individual lawyer skills and values so they can go out and represent every person the way they deserve to be represented. That alone is really important, but one lawyer isn't going to transform systems. So while that is an important part of what we do, ultimately our goal is to work with offices to transform offices. And the five programs you mentioned are all part of helping offices transform organizational culture. So with those five programs, an office that is in desperate need of culture change can use our law school pipeline to bring in client-centered lawyers that they otherwise might not have access to. They can bring in some of the most passionate future public defenders from across the country. Through the CORE 101 program, they can take their new lawyers and put them through a 3-year program where they have the right foundation. Through the alumni program, they can ensure those lawyers develop into tomorrow's leaders. Through the trainer development program, they can make sure that their supervisors in the office are learning and thinking about the same lessons and same values to reinforce what the new lawyers are learning. And through the leadership program, the leaders are part of it. So all five of those help us create client-centered offices. And I think what we've seen is in places like New Orleans, Houston, Nashville, where graduates of our Core 101 program are now running those offices have become organizations that are the engines of their criminal justice systems. They are the conscience of those systems. Those offices are pushing everyone else in the system to rethink what it means to give justice to people who don't have means, to people who live in the margins. And so I think all of those programs are critical to transforming offices. As we start to meet that success, I think we start to see more and more office leaders say, I want to participate in that. And that's how it spreads. So the more we are out there demonstrating what client center offices can mean to justice transformation, the more people want to be a part of it. And I think ultimately that made its way to Maine. When you ask the challenges that we face, I think there are a couple challenges. I think that there are always people who are very much, they benefit from the status quo. They do the work not because it's about serving people. They have a position in the criminal justice system that is comfortable, that is solidified, and they don't want offices that threaten the status quo. They benefit from systems that very cheaply process people. And I do think that justice requires us to spend more money, take more time, rethink the extent to which we are criminalizing certain behavior. It's a change in the way that we operate, and people, there are always going to be people resistant to change. I will also say, I think there are funders who very much want to see justice transformation, who still struggle to imagine public defenders as part of systemic change because they see public defenders as doing good work, but one client at a time. I think one of the challenges we have at Gideon's Promise is helping those funders understand that the work we're doing isn't just teaching lawyers to serve one person at a time, that if we develop leadership that can transform offices, those offices can drive systemic change. In fact, I would argue public defenders are the key to systems change. When you appreciate that public defenders represent roughly 80% of the people in the criminal legal system, and when I say public defenders, I mean lawyers who represent clients, whether through a public defender system, through an appointment system, they represent 80% of the people in the system. If you believe, as I do, that fundamentally the injustice we see in our system is because we have ignored the stories of certain people, that certain people are seen as others, are dehumanized, and you believe, as I do, that the engine to transform the system is to force the system to learn those stories, to hear those voices, to see the people behind the cases. If you believe that, then it's easy to understand why public defenders collectively have the power to learn the stories of 80% of the people in the system, to lift up those voices, to infuse the system with those stories. That drives narrative change. That changes a narrative that says some people don't matter. Public defenders have the power to transform that narrative when they are working in partnership with communities that have historically been disregarded in the criminal legal space.
When you mentioned in terms of obstacles in any system, there are people that benefit from the status quo. It's not just public defenders that may be comfortable in how their role is currently in their system and are threatened or don't like the idea of changing that because they're settled in their ways, but it's also the judges and the prosecutors who may not take kindly, as you mentioned earlier, from that example you had. I think it was when you were doing the training in Georgia. The judges get upset when we file motions. And I think that that's a manifestation of that status quo. And it's the, you know, the getting upset they were referring to wasn't so much the merits of the motion. It was the fact that there was a motion and they were going to have to look at it.
Well, Rob, I mean, if you think about it, we're celebrating the 250th anniversary of the nation, right? The nation grounded in a constitution where the men who drafted the constitution believed that the only way to get justice in the criminal legal system was through a process that included a trial. Plea bargaining wasn't a thing in 1776. They envisioned trials to be the mechanism where important decisions about justice were made in the criminal arena. Fast forward to today, in most places, more than 95% of cases are resolved with pleas. It's cheap, it's efficient. Judges and prosecutors benefit tremendously from being able to move cases from arrest to sentencing without a lot of cost and without a lot of time. And public defenders who understand how to litigate motions, the importance of litigating motions, the importance of pushing back against a system that is accepted, just processing people through the plea bargaining system, that is more time consuming. It is more expensive. Let me be clear, I believe there are some judges and prosecutors who appreciate that that's what justice requires, but there are many more who don't and who are going to be resistant to that. And if we are asking in the 250th anniversary of America to push to have justice like the men who drafted the Constitution envisioned, it is going to make a lot of people uncomfortable.
The last thing that I'm going to ask you about, and I will not try to read too much into this suggestion, but you mentioned a little bit about having a succession plan for Gideon's Promise. And again, I'm not going to try to read too much into this, but if you could talk a little bit about having it when you're building an organization that you want to outlive you, that you want its impact to continue beyond the efforts of a small group of energized people. Can you talk about that a little bit, just its importance, maybe either in these efforts to transform the system and in an organization, or just in terms of Gideon's Promise and how you guys came to reflect upon that, and then what you took into account when you were making that decision to plan for that?
So I'm not sure if I understand the question completely, Rob, but I think if I understand what you're asking, I think as we started to recognize that for Gideon's promise to have the impact that we desired, to be transformative, as we started to understand we needed to build a model that had more programs, that it wasn't just for new lawyers, right? We also recognized that as we grew, we had to have the human resources internally, and that we had to develop people who could administer the training and the mentorship so that we could replicate and grow. I think it became clear to me a decade ago that there were many, many people in the organization who were at least as talented as I was when it came to teaching, when it came to mentoring, when it came to training. And I think that was about when I started to realize that we were really in a good place to build a model that would not depend on me and Illy. What you saw when you came to trainer development, I think that's the proof of the pudding. I think what you saw at trainer development, I didn't have much to do with trainer development. If I was there, it wouldn't have added anything to trainer development. I there is nothing I could bring that that group of people don't bring to trainer development. That's succession planning.
And I think that you're right. And I mean that sincerely, that what you have put together and the small slice I've had the opportunity to participate in and to receive the benefits of really was impressive. And those individuals delivering it and supporting it were very impressive, capable, and dedicated. And I think that you have built something that stands on its own. And you should be very proud of that. It's very impressive.
I want to say there is one story I'd like to share with you all, just because I know you have a law student audience. And you can ultimately, if it makes it in or not, that you all can choose. But I think about this as a law teacher, because when I think about the culture of our criminal justice system, I think law schools are guilty of contributing to a legal landscape that doesn't sufficiently value people. I think what we are doing as public defender trainers and leaders is in many ways we're forced to undo some of the damage that happens in law school. And so I do orientation at my law school, and I ask this new crop of enthusiastic incoming 1Ls, why are you here? Why'd you come to law school? And they raise their hand, and one after the other, they have these kind of idealistic answers. I want to serve this group of people, or I want to deal with this societal problem. Then I share with them a quote from an unnamed law student that it says, "The first thing I lost in law school is the reason why I came." And I tell them, you're about to enter a first year where we are going to teach you that the law can be reduced to rules and doctrine and black letters on a white page. And before you know it, you'll forget that there are human beings behind these cases. And I challenge them. I say, at the end of your first year, you will have read dozens of cases. I want you to come back and share with me the story of one person behind one of the cases you've read. And none of them can do it because the casebook method, the way we teach lawyers, we even say we want you to think like a lawyer, which means it's all about your ability to rationally synthesize facts, right? We teach lawyers the cases are reduced to the facts needed to mechanically come up with a legal conclusion. And we strip it of the stories of the people and the emotion and the feeling. And I tell our students that you've got to learn what we're teaching in law school. You have to learn to analyze, you have to learn to reason. But if you do it at the expense of forgetting the laws about people, you will be a bad lawyer. And we are producing lawyers to come out of law school that think lawyering has everything to do with the rational part and nothing to do with the feeling. I think as public defender teachers and trainers, our job is to teach folks skills and knowledge and figure out how to put the feeling and the compassion and the humanity back into it. But most people who are perpetuating our criminal legal system come from legal educations where compassion and empathy were devalued. And that's what public defenders fight against when they try to fight for people in these systems.
Thank you. Are you okay if I maybe steal that when I talk to some of the students this summer?
Yeah, you can steal it.
Okay.
There's nothing I've told you that I haven't stolen from someone.
I just thought I had asked. Thank you for listening to Justice Radio. Tune in next time when we'll have a new topic in the area of criminal justice and indigent defense. A big thank you to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series.